All right. As we promised, we're finally now going to start talking about the six-day war. Now it's basically the countdown to war. So this is what we have to know. 1964, Israel completes a water carrier from the north of the country to the south along the Jordan River. We're on the year of kayaking in this river. But along the Jordan River, we have a national water carrier. And it's of extreme importance. I spoke about once in the Ashkenazi Dominion that we have to understand the miracles that have happened here and make the desert bloom and how Israel recycles water and desalinates water and just even transporting the water. Getting water from the north to the south, from the Banyas and all the way up to the north and down to the south, this is extremely important. Now, Syria tries to reroute the water, right? It's starting up in the Golan Heights, which is now in Syrian hands. Let's reroute the water and starve Israel to death, right? We'll cut off their water supply. This is the move.
Is that secure?
You're bringing that for me?
I was good. I'm bringing it both for you.
You're a tenant. That's extra croutons here for you.
No, that Edward goes, don't worry, Roger has the bowl.
Yeah, Edward brought it. Okay.
He did?
Yeah.
I'm knocking this face.
Okay.
Stone mitzvah.
Gotta love the fact that you'll fight over mitzvahs.
Perfect. He saw me doing that. Then he goes,
I'm not fighting over other things.
I'm actually going to hit him.
Fantastic.
Now, I'm actually going to hit him. I can't believe
you
did that.
I'm sure you are.
Anyway,
we're moving on.
Then he takes my boy.
Okay,
I'll
say, we're moving on.
I'm going to kill him. Are you kidding me?
Now, scum.
What a scum.
Okay. For all those who are listening, that was Yosef calling Edwin a scum. Now, Syria tries to reroute the water. And Israel retaliates. Now, there's an unwritten rule that the Air Force can't get involved. The Air Force means they need to go through all-out war. So, basically, there is just some fire across the border between Syria and Israel. Then, Syria starts to shell from the Golan Heights on farms of kibbutzim and Galilee. And at this point, finally, it took a while, but Prime Minister Levi Eshkol gives the green light, and Israel's Air Force is allowed to get involved. Now, as I said, this risks war. It risks Soviet intervention. April 7th, 1967, we mentioned this, I think, yesterday, the Syrian Air Force, with the most powerful Soviet planes, the MiG-21, went up against Israel's lighter French Mirage aircraft. And Israel took them out 6-0. Okay, knocked out of the sky 6 MiGs, 0 Israeli planes. Russia lost face. Gonna be that a Russian MiG loses in an air fight to a French Mirage. The United Nations scolds Israel, and the Arabs threaten. Now, what made it more embarrassing, after Israel took out in this dogfight 6-6 and knocked out 6-0, the Israeli pilots flew a victory lap over Damascus, much to the horror of the citizens and the government of Syria. Okay?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
T-foreign.
Yeah, little T-foreign. Now, with the Soviets pumping military equipment into Egypt and Syria and encouraging them to go to war, the Six-Day War was now inevitable. Rabbi Beryl Wine argues that you can make the argument that without Russian intervention, there never would have been a Six-Day War. But Russia was so embarrassed. Again, you have this minor war going out between the proxies and the Cold War between America and the United States. And not, it wasn't even the United States didn't really give us any weapons yet. Now, how could it be that the Russians' best aircraft goes down, this tiny little Israel? So Russia pushes its Arab proxies to get involved, and war is now, you know, on the offing.
That's crazy.
May 15th, Israel's Independence Day. Egyptian troops begin to move into the Sinai, massing near Israel's border. May 18th, Syrian troops start preparing for battle along the Golan Heights. And there, here's a crazy thing. We already mentioned in 1956, after the Sinai campaigns, the United Nations moved an emergency force into the Sinai, buffer between Egypt and Israel. Jamal Abdel Nasser, president of Egypt, tells the United Nations, get your force out of there. And without even, you know, checking with the cabinet and against what his predecessor had promised, the Secretary General of the United Nations, U Thant, says, okay, and pulls them out. As Avi even put it, what good is it, fire brigade, if it disappears the first signs of smoke and fire? Your whole purpose, your zone d'etre, is to be there and to make sure that there's no conflict. And when Nasser says, guys, get out of the way, they go, okay, no problem, we're leaving. So this is what happens in the Sinai. Nasser then gets on the Voice of Arabs and Proclaims, right? It's a radio station. As of today, there no longer exists an international emergency force to protect Israel. We shall exercise patience no more. We shall not complain anymore to the UN about Israel. The sole method we shall apply against Israel is total war, which will result in extermination of Zionist existence. Okay? Defense Minister of Syria, Hafez al-Assad, later on becomes Prime Minister, says our forces are now entirely ready not only to repulse the aggressions, but initiate the act of liberation itself, to explode Zionist presence in the Arab homeland. We mentioned once earlier in the year, for the Arabs it's not about land, it's a religious thing. If this was once Arab land, Jews cannot live here. They have these maps of green and brown areas.
How did they prove it was Arab land when really it was ours? And we have more.
They say that,
it wasn't even theirs,
they said that even afterwards, if Arabs lived there, even later, it's then Arab land. Doesn't matter what happened before that.
Yeah, but wouldn't like somebody just give up if we could prove, like, and we have just like so many facts to like back it up?
No,
they
but they'll say
up?
That first of all, they deny our facts.
Why do they say that?
They destroy all the as many artifacts as they can. Say there's never a temple here. Okay, there's never.
But they know they destroyed the artifacts.
I know.
They know someone. They don't want us to have it.
They're like I said. That's
still when you're wrong, doesn't it?
That is them trying to change history. But without that, the mere fact that Arabs lived here, they said that means now Arab land.
They have every other place. I don't know why Israel is like
any land that was occupied by Arabs. You can see how they, which color is which. There's brown and green areas in the world, and one of the colors is this means it was once Arab land and has to remain Arab land.
That's crazy.
So this is their, this is what they're saying, and that's why every time we sit there and say, "Oh, we'll make a little peace treaty," it's a joke because they don't want part of it. They want all of it. Right,
sure.
The peace treaty will be, okay, step one, now give us the next. You know, that's all it is.
There's one more.
Yeah. Now, this is what he says. Hafez al-Assad. The Syrian army with its finger on the trigger is united. I, as a military man, believe time has come to enter into a battle of annihilation. Okay? We are going to annihilate Israel. We're going to drive them into the sea. This is what Egypt is saying. This is what Syria is saying. The Jordanian king, King Hussein, says the armies of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon are poised on the borders of Israel to face the challenge while standing behind us are the armies of Iraq, Algeria, Kuwait, Sudan, the whole Arab nation. This act will astound the world. Today, we will know that the Arabs are arranged for battle. Critical hours arrive. We have reached the stage of serious action and not declarations. All right, the president of Iraq similarly says the existence of Israel is an error which must be rectified. Is an opportunity to wipe out the disgrace which has been with us since 1948. Our goal is clear, to wipe Israel off the map. Okay? And due to this, Arab rhetoric, 465,000 troops and 2,800 tanks, 800 aircraft are now surrounding Israel.
How much is it again?
465,000 soldiers. More than 2,800 tanks and 800 planes are surrounding Israel, ready to go to battle. Okay? A week later, they closed the Straits of Tehran. Once again, if you recall, we said in 1956, one of the achievements of the Sinai campaign was they reopened for Israel shipping the Straits of Tehran, which would bring them goods from Asia to Eilat, especially oil from Iran, which we already mentioned. At this point, Israel has good relations with Iran. And now this was closed. This is what's known as an act of war. Okay?
Is this route, is
coming up.
Where is it located?
It's coming up from the south, coming up to Israel.
Reopened and gave
I've
food
seen that.
To where?
I was there.
What?
And gave food to where?
This is where we would get shipping from Iran, oil from Iran.
I was there.
People like freaking out in Israel?
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that. Israel goes to the United States. And United States says, don't worry about it, it's all good. And, you know, we're going to test the blockade. And, you know, really, it's okay. Now, most Israelis didn't believe this, and they believed the whole thing was a joke, because whose idea was it? The French? And the French never did anything they say. And this is what Johnson is telling, LBJ is telling Israel. Just to get an idea of the difference between how the Americans approach this and how the Jews approach this in Israel. I mentioned to you two books that I recommended, written by Herman Wouk. Herman Wouk wrote A Hope and a Glory. Both of them, I told you, historical fiction. The Hope is 48 to 73, Glory is 73 to 2000. And he puts fictional characters in place with all these real people. And I said, a lot of research. The history is solid. Here is, this is like a, you know, made-up story, but one of his fictional characters is now speaking in the United States before the Six-Day War, trying to get people to understand the situation in Israel. So I'm picking it up in the middle of some banquet, and it says like this. The other main speaker, a tall, bald U.S. senator, was waving his arms and pounding the podium. Now, my friends, just a word about these new truth movements in Sinai. Three American presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, have pledged that America will never let Israel be destroyed. This loudmouth Colonel Nasser is bluffing, as usual. In my view, the crisis will blow over unless he makes a mistake of his life. In that case, Israel will prevail. Standing ovation. All right. The Ares, that's this guy Benny, who's, you know, Israel's representative here, in a light dress uniform with no medals, rose to speak after a long flowery introduction by the banquet chairman. And this is what he says. I ask all of you in this audience, he began, to rearrange your country a bit in your imagination. Start with Rhode Island and surround it with some real big states. Say, put Texas to the south, Illinois on the north, California on the west, and the fourth border is the Atlantic Ocean as now. All right, good. Then behind those three states, my friends, put Michigan, Pennsylvania, New York. Let's say all six are at war with Rhode Island. All in a pact to wipe it out and drive its people into the ocean. Benny turned to the senator sitting beside him. Mr. Senator, give him that picture. It's nice to have your assurance that Rhode Island will prevail. Yeah. The senator gave him a nonplussed half smile, especially since, to complete the picture, I'd have to put north of it in Illinois, a superpower violently hostile to Rhode Island, talking about Soviet Union, and committed to all-out military support for its enemies. A pause. Sober faces all over the ballroom. Fine. Now I'll make my speech. Like the Senate, my friends, I just wanted to cheer you up. And then we'll start laughing. Okay, fine. But that's the difference. You know, very nice for America to say, don't worry, Israel will prevail. Yeah, you're not there. We're all here, and they're attacking us. Okay. This period, from basically Yom HaAtzmaut until the war breaks out, is known as in Israel, Hahamtana. Lantin is what? Sichot Hamtana? Sichot Hamtana is called waiting. Hamtana is waiting. Okay? This was the period of waiting. Okay? It was very tense. That's what you're getting to. What do we do? Right? The Egyptian Air Force, on May 17th, I mentioned this the other day, flew two, first ever, they flew two MiG-21s on a reconnaissance mission over Dimona. It came up through Jordan, shot out from Jordan over Israeli airspace, over the Dimona nuclear reactor, or textile factory as we like to call it, and before the Israeli army was able to respond, even to recognize what had just happened, they were already out of airspace.
Who was this, the
Egyptian Air Force with their MiG-21s came in through Jordan and cut through Israeli airspace right over the Dimona nuclear reactor.
Wow.
Okay? Nasser had been already saying that, you know, this is going to be a cause of war, and it's possible to say that Israel was so scared about a strike that Israel's fear for the reactor, rather than Egypt's fear of the reactor, was a greater catalyst for war. Right? Israel will, for the first time, realize, you know, they can take out the nuclear reactor. Right? The way, like, later we'll talk about when Israel takes out Iraq's nuclear reactor, or even later, Syria's nuclear reactor, right? And hopefully soon, Iran's nuclear reactor. But whatever, Israel's scared about a potential attack on Dimona. Now, what's going on in Israel? Prime Minister Levi Eshkol in consultation with Lyndon Baines Johnson, President of the United States, is explaining, listen, there's a massive buildup all over. We need your support. We need weapons. We need you to have our back. We need you to threaten the Soviet Union the way the Soviet Union is threatening us. And Johnson's saying, don't worry about it. He's good. We're not doing anything. There's no arms delivery. There's nothing. Right? Lady Eshkol's basically went, pleaded his case to LBJ. Nothing. He then goes to, who were Israel's allies in 56? France and England, right? He goes to De Gaulle. You know, President of France. Pleads his case. And De Gaulle basically gives him a cold shoulder. When De Gaulle is reminded about the commitments that he made to Israel in 1957, his response was terse. That was 57. This is 67. Okay. I know I said that. That was then. And this is now. You know, I'm like, and you know, it is what it is. He goes to Harold Wilson, Prime Minister of Britain. Same thing.
What's our question?
Yes.
At this time, Israel didn't want war. Israel didn't want war?
Israel does not want war. Israel wants...
Yeah, but didn't we want to get Yerushalayim back?
No. No. Israel wanted to live in peace. Israel wanted to live in peace. They were surrounded, so far outnumbered. Okay? This goes back to, you know, before you were here, we talked about the revisionist view and the, I guess, the pragmatist view. Ben-Gurion said, okay, they're going to do a partition plan. They're going to give us something for the United Nations. We'll say thank you very much. And Jabotinsky and revisionists said, no, Israel goes all the way to the Euphrates. Right? We learn Gemara Bamitzia. We said we can walk 15 days on Nar Prat. That was all part of biblical Israel. That's what we should have. That was Palestine. Right? So here as well, Israel saying, we have something. First time in 2,000 years. Let's live in peace. They're not looking to make the country bigger.
I was
we need to survive.
I was we're trying to get Yerushalayim. Well, okay, fine.
The war is a war that we end up fighting, a war of survival. Does it turn into something much bigger? Yeah. But that wasn't the goal. The goal was to survive.
You don't have the full biblical Israel there, right?
Right. It depends also. There's different borders in the Torah for what full biblical
or
Israel
close.
Is. Okay? But there's different, like I said, it's possible by Mashiach time we'll have all of Jordan as well. Go to the Euphrates. That's what was promised to Abraham. By the time we came with Yeshua, we're pretty close. Yeah, pretty close. Now, they complain to Russian foreign minister, the Russian ambassador to Israel, and he says, oh, you think there's Syrian troop movements? You think there's Egyptian troop movements? Oh, you fools, you're being suckered in by CIA provocations. Oh, right, that must be what's happening. So, you know, but again, we said before, Russia's the one that's really pushing Israel to do this. Now, the Israeli public at this point is getting very agitated. The army, they're calling up reservists. 80,000 reservists are now called up. The price of mobilizing reservists is staggering. The whole economy comes to a halt. Everyone stops their jobs there. Like, what's going on? And they're waiting. That's this whole hamtana. People are waiting. Right before my sons went into Gaza in 2009, also they were called up. Before they actually went, it took a long time. Not like this, and it wasn't as tense. But, you know, first you're called, but then they stop. Right? So now what's going on? Ben-Gurion, who's out of office, is castigating Eshkol and saying, what did you do? You know, you're crazy here. You made those belligerent statements. Not happy. He said the Air Force, 6-0, you know, making everyone lose face. And he said, you brought this upon us. Now you got the Soviet Union all upset. Yitzhak Rabin, the chief of staff, and he's feeling it even more. The Soviet Union, they're threatening military action if Israel attacks. And the United States promises Russia that it would restrain Israel. There were rumors that the USSR was supplying Arabs with gas, which obviously brought the vote memories of what? Holocaust, which was, I mean, you have survivors that are now fighting, right? Robin said, this is so tense. They've moved it up to the borders that a single sniper bullet shot by mistake could start an all-out war, and that we have to do something. Okay, and yet, Levi Eshel says, we're not going to do anything militarily until we've exhausted all diplomatic options, because we don't want to go to war. This is Levi Eshel. Don't want to go to war. Okay. Now, Robin's thinking about, we have to do a preemptive attack, and we're going to talk about this more tomorrow. Okay, we need to do this in order to move a ground attack. And he says to Avi Eben, let's say we have this preemptive attack. Let's say we then mobilize our ground forces. How long till the United Nations will force us to stop? And Avi Eben says, 24 to 72 hours. He goes, I can't do that. Because I need time. Now it gets back to you, Sam. If I'm going to risk so many soldiers, I need time to actually conquer land. I can't sit there only to be called off if we actually make any gains.
Say it again.
Yitzhak Rabin says, let's say we shoot the first shot, right? We do a preemptive attack. How long before the United Nations will force us to stop? And he says, you have 1 to 3 days maximum. And he says, that's not enough time. I need time to actually conquer some land.
I love that.
Right? He said, what good is going to war, losing the best of our soldiers, only to have nothing to show for it, which is sort of what happened after 56. That's what we talked about. On the one hand, Ben-Gurion saying, we have another Maim at Har-Sinai, we captured the Sinai, only to be told by Eisenhower, give everything back. Like, right? So he said, I can't do that again. We need time. Now, Robin is smoking heavily. He's existing on black coffee. Reporters see him, they say he's in a daze. He is summoned to Ben-Gurion's house. Where's Ben-Gurion's house? Where we stopped at the bus in the state of Boker, down in the Negev. Miriam Eshkol, Prime Minister's wife, says, why did you go to him? He says, Ben-Gurion calls, you go. He's not even part of the government anymore, right? Ben-Gurion starts ripping on him. Okay, now, like I said, very difficult for Robin to hear this. Ben-Gurion saying, I can't believe, you know, what you did. You're going to cause the annihilation of Israel. You agitated everyone against us. Not only that, you don't have any superpower on your side. Now, to this, Robin was disappointed. So Ben-Gurion's been out of government for 5 years, and he didn't realize how strong the IDF has grown. And he felt we're still circa 1956. We need to elect France and England, you know, for us to fight against Egypt. And he felt that we don't need them. And just bigger is not in touch. So on the one hand, you know, he listened, but he didn't think he was right. But he did come out after being castigated, felt like, you know, kids, you know, scolded by the school principal, and he walked out dazed, his cigarette drooping from his mouth. Now, as I said, now we're a week into this build-up. The Straits of Tehran is closed. This is known as an act of war. And they could go to war. And that's what people are saying to Levi Eshkol. Let's go to war. They get together in the headquarters. And there's all sorts of discussions going on. Azar Weitzman, who is like second in command of the Air Force, who himself had been a pilot, and he says, we have to strike now, swiftly. We have to deal the enemy a serious blow. If we don't, other forces will soon join against us. Syrian, Sudanian positions depend on our success in Egypt. We have to strike first, and more about Syrian and Jordan later. But Egypt's our main foe. We have to take them out first. Now, with all of this, what everyone's saying, Levi Eshkol is still, he's in this very difficult situation. He's trying to convince the United States and the international community why Israel needs to go to war, which is what the Israelis want to do, and at the same time convince the Israelis why we shouldn't go to war, what the international community is telling them not to do. Right? So this is your Levi Eshkol. You're not in a very, you know, easy situation. This is the predicament that you find yourself. In the cabinet, they're attacking Yitzhak Rabin. Would Israel attack Syria? You know, we just worry about Egypt, or we'd also attack Syria. What would happen if while we're now attacking Egypt, like you say, every single plane is now in the south Syria goes in and attacks from the north, and we left the entire country open. Is it possible that we'll be annihilated in this way? And Robin's saying we can expect bombardment. I don't think they'll come in. They say to Weitzman. Weitzman gets upset. He's like disgusted. Think what you think that we can't take them on. Weitzman's very he's a bragger. And he's saying we'll lose planes. Yes, we'll lose lots of planes, but we'll win just because we're better. All right. Now this is very easy for him to say. All the other Knesset members are looking like, says you. But we're so outnumbered. And you have people sitting there saying, I am not going to be a part of watching the state of Israel get annihilated. We're not going to do something that is so foolhardy. You have people that are so disappointed in the indecisiveness of Lady Eshkol that they say, let's bring Ben Gurion back. He goes about for 5 years. Ben Gurion is the most popular person that Israel had ever known. And they say, bring him back as defense minister. Because up until now, every prime minister was prime minister and defense minister. You know, let him at least be defense minister. You know who even favored this? Who was Ben Gurion's arch enemy in the Knesset?
Begin.
Begin said, let's bring Ben Gurion back. At this point, there was a national unity government. In order to, we're now going to have some massive war. Who knows what's going to be? In order to make sure that everyone is united, the opposition was invited to become members of Knesset, members of the government, not just Knesset. So now, Begin is brought in as a minister without portfolio, but he's a minister. So he's involved in decision making. And Begin says, bring Ben Gurion back. Although he also, after visiting him, was disappointed in how out of touch he has been being out of the government for the last 5 years, and wavered afterwards about that. But again, it's showing what's going on here. Abba even is talking about how this is a move we have to make because it's the right move. Right now, we were given these assurances that the straits will be open. If the straits are not open, so we're like, you know, we get pushed around and we don't fight back. Right? If you're that kid that the bully punches and you just like say, thank you, sir. Thank you, so I have another, you know. So we bullied your whole life. You can't sit there. So they now close it. What?
You gotta take a stand.
Gotta take a stand? Alright, my kids were little. They went to school. Said, someone hits you, hit it back harder.
That's it.
That was it. So they won't hit you again. I once had, it was very cool. It's sort of weird that I'm saying this on the corner, but I'll tell you anyway. We got a phone call from a mother saying, your son, you know, beat up my kid on the bus. So that was a little weird because my son was in second grade and her son was in fourth grade. Part of me was saying, well, son, fourth grade, can't take on my second grade kid. Something wrong with your kid. But anyway, I go over to him, I go, why'd you beat up this kid? He goes, he's picking on Tali, his older sister. I said, good for you. Picking on your sister and you had her back? Good for you.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. Anyway, you know, I think he felt like, oh, I can pick on my sister. I was picking on my sister. No. Anyway, so now, the weight of decision making was so extensive on Yitzhak Rabin that he didn't know what to do with himself. He tells Lady Eshkol, look, we're going to suffer a lot of losses, but we got to do it. So now there was like this little like song, this morale-boosting song that was going around Israel at the time, saying that, you know, Nasi mechakel Rabin. Nasi is waiting for Rabin. You know, your move. All right? What are you going to do? And Rabin writes in his memoirs, well, if Nasi was waiting for Rabin, Rabin was waiting for Eshkol. Eshkol was waiting for Cabin. Cabin was waiting for Abi to get back to the United States. Abi was waiting for President Johnson. There's a whole chain of things that was going on here before Yitzhak Rabin could do anything.
Why didn't he just go? He's prime minister, no?
Who?
No, Rabin was prime minister.
No.
Rabin was
Lady Eshkol's prime minister.
Rabin was the best minister.
He was, no.
No.
He is chief of staff.
Chief of staff, right.
Okay.
Sorry.
Right? Chaim Moshe Shapiro reprimands him from the religious Mizrahi party. He says, now we'll be totally isolated. We won't receive armed supplies if we run short during the fighting. Do you want to bear the responsibility for endangering Israel? I shall resist it as long as I breathe. Just so you should understand, it wasn't like everyone wanted to go to war. You had at least half of the cabinet, and I'm sad to say, including the religious ministers, saying, we don't need Yerushalayim. We don't need to go to war. We have what we have. We're risking the whole state? Enough. What we have is fine. Yitzhak Rabin, no one knew this at the time, he had a mental breakdown. He snapped. He writes in his memoirs that he sunk into profound crisis that was brought on by guilt. Said, I led the country into war under the most difficult circumstances. Everything was on my shoulders, rightly or wrongly. I hadn't eaten almost for 9 days. Hadn't slept. Was smoking nonstop. Was physically exhausted. His wife, Leah, forbade him from going on some tour of you know, where the army was set up in their stations. Robin calls in Ezra Weitzman, his second in command. And according to Weitzman, Robin asked him to assume command. Okay? Weitzman said no. Later on, Robin denies that he asked him to assume command. But that he basically had a breakdown, that's for sure. As far as the public knew, they thought Robin was sick with nicotine poisoning. That was it. But as he writes in his memoirs, he cracked. There was so much pressure. Now, think about that. If you were actually an Israeli citizen, how much more would you be freaking out? My chief of staff now is so scared, he cracked. How would that make you feel? I think it would make you feel, you know, calm at all. Avi even goes abroad and he says all sorts of speeches. Avi even was great. He was loved in Chutz Laretz. Okay? Who was Avi even? Avi even was educated in Cambridge, spoke many languages, and he was loved in Eretz Israel. No one had any respect for him. Eretz Israel, Lady Eshkol referred to him as the Galenter Navi. Lady Eshkol was like so for himself, spoke Yiddish all the time. Called him the Galenter Navi, the learned idiot. That's what he called him. Sounds really good. You know, basically he said he's got lots of good speeches, no good ideas. And he would have all sorts of amazing, great lines. After the 1948 partition plan is rejected by the Arabs go to war, Israel gains more land, and the Arabs then sue in the United Nations to get their land back. He says they're like a child who, after killing his parents, pleads for mercy as an orphan. Right? Get the line?
No, fit again.
He said the Arabs are like the child who, after killing his parents, pleads for mercy as an orphan.
Oh.
Right? Like, they brought this upon themselves. Why are they doing it? Anyway, Lady Eshkol felt he didn't live in reality. And if he had his druthers, he would have sent Golda Meir, who he trusted much more, to the United States. But she had taken ill. And Avi even goes. And he makes amazing speeches. And he basically wins over support for Israel. There was like all sorts of postcards and telegrams coming to the White House. 90% are in favor of Israel and the United States should help. No, they don't. I'm just saying he changes the opinion. Now, here's what Golda Meir wrote in her memoir. There were also the grim preparations that had to be kept secret. This is June 1967. The parks in each city have been consecrated for possible use as mass cemeteries. There were 10,000 graves dug by the Chevra Kadisha because they were assuming there'd be so many casualties there won't be time to start burying people in cemeteries. There wasn't even a room. They started in parks. They started making places, making it into another cemetery. Okay, hotels were cleared of guests so they could be turned into huge emergency first aid stations. Rations were stockpiled against the time when the population might have to be fed from some central source. The bandages, drugs, stretches obtained and distributed. And of course, above all, there were the military preparations, because even though we had by now absorbed the fact that we were entirely on our own, there wasn't a single person in Israel, as far as I know, who had any illusions about the fact that there was no alternative whatsoever to winning the war that was being thrust upon us. When later on, President Nixon had said to Golda Meir, "How did you guys win?" She said two words, "Ein Brera." We didn't have a choice. We're not a big enough country to like take a big loss and then regroup. We take a big loss, we're over. Ein Brera. We had no alternative but to win. When I think about back to those days, what stands out in my mind is the miraculous sense of unity and purpose that transformed us within only a week or two from a small, rather claustrophobic community, coping, in other ways, well, all sorts of economic, political, and social discontent into 2.5 million Jews, each and every one of whom felt personally responsible for the survival of the state of Israel. And each and every one knew that the enemy we faced was committed to our annihilation. Right? This is what she writes. Now, to make matters worse, okay? I said, here it is, a buildup that runs waiting. And the Army Reserves are called up and not going to war. Okay? They don't know it yet, but our chief of staff is having a mental break with them. America is not helping. No international country is. The Arabs are there, and the Soviets are feeding them and saying, go, go, go. Lady Eshkol gets on the radio. There's no television yet in Israel. And he made a speech, and it's the anti-Churchill. If Churchill made amazing speeches and gave people around, Lady Eshkol's speech had the opposite effect. Not all his fault. He had just had cataract surgery. He was given a speech, not a chance to look over it, and the army censor had now ripped out and blackened out different parts, so he's sort of like on the fly reading this disjointed speech. But if you were listening, it sounded like he himself had lost hope of victory. It sounded like he didn't have confidence. And soldiers who were listening by tanks on the radio started to cry. Because their prime minister, it sounded as if, didn't think they had a chance.
Well, yeah, because he didn't want to go to war at all. That kind of makes sense.
Okay. The one thing they do, and this is the last thing we'll talk about, okay, there are armed people saying they have to go to war. Ariel Sharon says today, he's talking about, he's upset that they haven't gone to war yet. We have removed with our own hand our most powerful weapon, the enemy's fear of us. We have the power to destroy the Egyptian army. But if we give in on the free passage issue, right, the Straits of Tehran, we've opened the door to Israel's destruction. We'll have to pay a far higher price in the future for something that we, in any case, had to do now. The people of Israel are ready to wage a just war, to fight, pay the price. The question isn't free passage, but the existence of the people of Israel. I'm stopping in a minute. The one move that Israel does do to calm both the cabinet and the public is they do name a chief of a minister of defense. They bring back out of retirement Moshe Dayan.
Wow.
Moshe Dayan for Israel is like the symbol of a warrior. So
Yavash.
He now comes back. What?
Yavash.
Right. Yeah, Moshe Dayan.
He comes back. He's a crazy person. Right? His whole life is filled with contradictions. Okay, I'll read to you quickly. Dayan was a classic man of contradiction. Famed as a warrior, he professed deep respect for the Arabs, including those who attacked his village, Nahlal, in the early 30s, who once beat him and left him for dead. A poet, a writer of children's stories, he admitted publicly he regretted having children. How would you feel if you were one of his kids? He was a renowned philanderer, right, an adulterer, adultery, a lover of the land who had made a hobby of plundering it. He amassed a huge personal collection of antiquities that he stole. A stickler for military discipline, he was prone to show contempt for the law. As one former classmate remembered, he was a liar, a braggart, a schemer, a prima donna, and in spite of that, the object of deep admiration. Moshe Dayan came in, and he basically says that the only chance we have is to take the war to them, and tomorrow, that's what we'll talk about.
Yo!
Day one.
Cliffhanger, what happened?